the night sky in focus and the latest news from space. This is The Sky Tonight with Pete Singleton and Cambridge astronomers Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough. Only on HCR 104 FM.
You're listening to The Sky Tonight, looking towards the stars each month on HCR 104 FM.
Hello again and welcome to The Sky Tonight, HCR 104 FM's monthly astronomy show, looking at the stars and discussing the latest events in space. I'm Pete Singleton and I'm joined by Paul Fellows, Chairman of the Cambridge Astronomical Association, and Jonathan Clough, also of the CAA, and both Fellows of the Royal Astronomical Society. On this edition, we will be looking at Object 2014, UN217, and a possible rendezvous. We'll have a chat about photographing the Milky Way. And, of course, we had a solar eclipse last month, and the Cambridge Astronomical Association, easy for me to say, streamed it to the world live from Back Gardens in Cambridgeshire. And we'll look at space missions and China's plans to set foot on Mars. And there's a story about a wooden satellite. And the 82-year-old female aviator, Wally Funk, originally from the Mercury program in the United States, at last she is destined for a trip into space. And if I haven't already mentioned it, there's been some trouble with Hubble. We'll talk about that. And, of course, the July night sky, what we can see, what we can't see, and generally how we can see it. Okay, but first then, let's have a look at Object 2014, UN217. Good evening. Paul, perhaps you'd like to open up on this one, please.
Yes, Pete. Very interesting outer solar system object that has been discovered. It was actually photographed as part of another survey that was looking at dark energy, which is another whole topic. But it just goes to show how sometimes surveys that are carried out for one reason turn out to be useful for another.
Right.
So this object is about 100 kilometres in diameter, which is pretty big, actually. It's getting on for dwarf planet size, if you think about it. Certainly very large for an asteroid. And initially, we're not sure whether it's an asteroid or a comet. It seems to have come in on a very, very long orbit, way out from the outer solar system, probably from the Oort cloud. They first picked it up in 2014, hence the name, and that was just beyond the orbit of Neptune at the time and heading in towards the solar system. It's now passed the planet Uranus at just recently, and is still heading in, but it's only going to come in as far as Saturn in about 10 years. So it's going to take it another 10 years to reach closest approach.
And why are we excited about this, Paul?
Well, we've never really had a chance to understand an object that is probably as pristine and ancient a part of the original solar system as this. It's taken 1.5 million years to come in from the frozen reaches of the Oort cloud. And while we've seen a few other objects that have come in to the solar system from that distance, there's a chance that with 10 years warning, we might be able to send a probe there.
Oh, okay.
And manage to rendezvous with it and get some images up close and personal, just if we get our act together very, very quickly.
So we're not talking about landing on this thing?
Well, a bit like the Rosetta mission of going and flying alongside it, going into orbit around it. It's got enough mass for us to be able to do that. And perhaps if it's warmed up a little bit on its journey into the solar system, getting nearer the sun, maybe it'll start to form a cometary tail so we could fly through the tail and make samples of the material that's coming off.
So we're looking at the usual comet type of icy snowball thing, or?
Probably we're expecting to find that it's made of the usual mixture of frozen ices, carbon monoxide, methane, carbon dioxide, water, ammonia, and so on. But it will be very interesting to see what else is mixed in with those ices, and whether they contain organic chemicals, perhaps the seeds of the biochemistry of life. And if that is the case, and then it just sort of spreads further the region in which those sorts of chemicals can get formed. They don't necessarily have to be formed as a result of the action of sunlight on chemistry. If they're being formed on an object that's hardly spent any time at all near the sun. So it'll be very interesting to find out.
How was this first detected, Paul, and who or what organisation first clapped eyes on it?
They were using the photographic results from this dark energy survey, which was really trying to photograph Type 1A supernovae, exploding stars out there in the universe. But two astronomers, Bernstein and another Italian astronomer whose name is almost exactly the same but ends in Enelli, so it's very hard to say actually, both made the same discovery. And with comets, they always name them as named after the first two people to report them. So we could call this Comet BB for short, really. Mm-hmm. As I say, it's a good example of how data collected for one purpose can lead to discoveries that of things that you were not even looking for.
Indeed. So you say we're looking at sort of a 10-year sort of chance to get something out there to rendezvous with it?
It's just possible that we've got 10 years before it reaches its closest approach, and then probably another 10 years while it's then receding from us. So there's a sort of 20-year window of opportunity to send a probe out there. And when you bear in mind that things like the New Horizons probe that went to Pluto, I think that only took 10 years from launch. So if a probe of a standardized pre-existing design could be put together, and there's a number of such designs in progress for probes to go out to Jupiter in that sort of time frame. So perhaps one of them can be repurposed, and this is causing the excitement.
Perhaps so. Okay, well, we'll watch that with interest, Paul. Thank you. Now, let's move on to the big news last month. Well, one of the big stories was the solar eclipse. Now, of course, it wasn't a full total eclipse from the UK, was it? But I understand, Paul and Jonathan, Jonathan, perhaps you can come in here, that the Cambridge Association did some live streaming.
That's right. We were, I think, one of the few organisations who actually managed to get some decent footage of it. We had four telescopes strung out in a line, And even though it was a cloudy day, and the observations were, it was a bit difficult to see. We had our vice chair and leader, Brian Lister, giving long talk at the beginning of the eclipse, because at that point, none of us could see it. But the clouds cleared, I think, with Paul first, actually. He was on the west end of the chain, so to speak. And Paul was using a solar scope and gave us some views. We had two other people with solar scopes, and we had me with an ordinary scope with a solar filter and a mobile phone, also able to get images. So between us and with Paul cutting between the four, we are actually able to show the whole cycle of the eclipse from the first encounter, the first little nibble out of the sun, through to the highest inclusion, which was about 30% coverage of the sun. So you say it was only a partial eclipse from the UK. The full solar eclipse was actually taking part in northern Canada and actually swept across into northern Russia. And we were able to link in to the feed coming from there as well. So between us, we showed what you could see from home, plus the full annular solar eclipse, which could be seen from Canada.
Really good. So, Paul, your take on all this. What equipment were you using?
Well, I had my solar telescope, which is an 80-millimeter refractor, but it's got a very cunning special filter, one of Newton's inventions, in fact, that cuts out all the light except for the wavelength of light that comes from hydrogen gas.
All right. And
so in addition to seeing the moon moving across the face and taking a bite out of the sun, I could also look at the surface of the sun and see the granulations on it. It's like the sort of boiling pot of treacle or something. And on the edge of the sun, we could see some prominences, great big sort of solar flares that were spewing material out away from the surface of the sun. And they were changing just minute by minute as we were looking. And it's amazing when you think that each of them was many times larger than the planet Earth would be. So we had more to look at just than a piece of the sun has gone missing.
Mm.
And then, as Jonathan said, we were very lucky to be able to hook a feed from the Canadian side, where the whole of the moon went right in front of the sun. But because it was a little bit at the outer reach of its elliptical orbit, it wasn't enough to fully block everything. So you got a ring of fire around the outside of the moon. And as it was moving across, it started to cover the whole disk. And it was like these two horns of bright light were converging to form and link up to make the ring of fire. But they didn't do it evenly, because there are mountains on the moon. And you could see that the light was kind of jumping forward between and peeking out between the peaks of the mountains on the moon, creating what's called Bailey's beads. So it was making a very uneven progress until you got this entire ring of fire. And that only lasted about a minute or two before then the moon moved along on its orbit, and the reverse process happened the other side. And so we cut away to view that. It was absolutely fantastic. And then came back to base, to my observatory, and to Jonathan from his back garden, and to, Mick Jenkins actually was joining us from the other side of Cambridge over at Swaffham Bulbeck. So we had this line of telescopes spanning some 15 miles or so, which made it incredibly successful, because the clouds were whizzing across. So every few minutes, one of us would go, "I've got it." And then, "Oh, no, I haven't. Oh, look, there's clouds again." But between the four observing sites, including the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge, we had coverage pretty much the whole event.
And of course, Paul, whilst your equipment is somewhat superior to others, no doubt, you didn't need that much. You could just use a piece of card and with a pinhole in it.
Yes, actually, Jonathan demonstrated that during the session, didn't you?
I did. I mean, I made a very simple one with a cardboard box and a piece of foil. A pinhole in the foil, projecting an image of the sun onto a piece of paper. And it's a very small image, but you could see the little bite out of the sun. I also saw some images which were taken elsewhere of people using a colander and actually just holding the colander up and letting the light project through the holes, and then you get multiple images of the moon. But as you say, you don't need very high-tech equipment at all.
No. And, of course, it's one of the safest ways to do it.
Definitely, because you're not looking directly at the sun.
Mm. Okay, then. We've got a couple of minutes left in this first segment. Do you want to kick off some space news, Jonathan, please?
Yeah, I'll start off with the Chinese, because they've been very busy. We talked last month about them launching parts of their space station, and subsequently they've actually put their astronauts onto the space station. Now, June the 17th, the astronauts arrived, three Chinese astronauts. And actually, in the last few days, they've done a double spacewalk, which is a first for China. And the purpose of the spacewalk was to test the spacesuits, which is a bit worrying. But they have done spacewalks before, but not for a while and not with this design. So checking the spacesuits out, and also their prime mission on this 3-month stay on the space station is to basically commission it, because they want to have further missions. The space station will be operational for some years. And so they're busy making sure it all works. They've got a robotic arm, a little bit like the Canadian robotic arm on the ISS. They've got, at the moment, they've got a habitation module. Further modules will be arriving, and they're getting supplies sent up there. It's a significantly smaller space station than the ISS, but even so, it's another presence in space. And I think even if the ISS does end up being decommissioned for any reason, then it will mean that there'll be this continuing presence of humans in space.
Yeah.
There is also talk of the Russians potentially collaborating with the Chinese, so you might get cosmonauts visiting the space station. And one little story I quite liked was the choice of food they've got. This is the place to be if you like Chinese cooking, obviously, because it's a Chinese space station. They've got 140 different dishes to choose from. Wow. I worked it out. That's actually a different meal for every meal they have over their 3-month stay. And apparently they like the spicy food more than sweet and sour. So it's a place to be. And fortunately, all three like it. Otherwise, you'd imagine one person who didn't like it would be quite fun.
Okay, we need to take a break, gentlemen. I'd like to, when we come back after the break, we're going to be talking about photographing the Milky Way. We just mentioned the wooden satellite story when we come back, Jonathan, and there's been some trouble with Hubble.
Coming to you live from our corner of the universe, this is The Sky Tonight on HCR 104 FM. On HCR 104 FM.
Well, welcome back to The Sky Tonight, and I'm Pete Singleton, and I've got with me Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough from the Cambridge Astronomical Association. First of all, just finishing off some space news, what's this about a wooden satellite, gentlemen?
Well, we've all heard the old joke about the guy who designed the wooden car with a wooden engine and wooden wheels wouldn't go. This is the space age version of it, and hopefully it will go. It's a wooden satellite designed by a company called Arctic Astronautics, as a Finnish company. So you think saunas and things, don't you? It actually is made out of a sort of pine. It's a nano satellite. It's tiny. It's 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters and weighs a kilo. So it's a little satellite, and it's really designed for use as a school project. It's to get children involved and the colleges involved in designing things. And its main payload is going to be a radio receiver, which will allow radio amateurs to send and receive images and pictures using the satellites. A good experiment. But the novelty is that it's made of wood. It is coated with various different things. And they're testing it, really, to see how well it holds out in space as an alternative material to the usual space-grade metals, which are used to build satellites with. I think it's one of those experiments where you don't really know whether there'll be a benefit or not. Mm. And they'll be measuring the degradation of the wood. They've got various coatings on it. It'll fly in its orbit about 300 miles up, they'll test to see how well it all works out.
Well, we'll see then. Okay. Paul, there's been some trouble with Hubble, apparently.
Yes, it seems that it's finally coming to the sticky end that's always been predicted, I fear. Computer systems have all shut down, and they don't seem to be able to get them to restart. So we've had various occurrences before where it's kind of gone into safe mode. And they've been able to do things like software upgrades and so on. But that none of that seems to be working at the moment. So it's been offline and it's certainly looking bad.
Dare I ask, is there any news about the James Webb Telescope?
Well, for that, actually, I'm just going to say join the Cambridge Astronomical Association talk on the 16th.
Ah, right.
Because we've got Dr. Emma Curtis-Lake, who's going to talk to us about her plans with the James Webb. And so that's still all going ahead. But I did hear one rather curious statistic about the James Webb Telescope, which is it's only going to have 4 years' supply of cooling helium on board.
Right.
So its lifetime as regards being able to operate properly might be rather short, just 4 years. When you compare that to Hubble, which has been going, what, 30 years now?
Yeah.
Just a four-year lifespan. And, of course, they're going to park it so far away from the Earth, a million miles out into space, that it's very unlikely they're going to be able to send a tanker out to top it up or anything.
No, absolutely not.
So I was not convinced by that, really.
No. Well, we'll just have to see what happens. Before we go on to about the Milky Way, Jonathan, very, very quickly, SpaceX, NASA, and perhaps you can mention Boeing and...
Yeah, the whole McCoy. I mean, it's actually not an awful lot to me is sort of currently totally planned. SpaceX has seemed to have scrapped all of their intermediate missions, and they're now looking for their mission 20, which might well fly on top of their Super Heavy booster and be a proper orbital flight. But we don't have a launch date for that. But we do know that they've got permission now to actually install satellite systems using their own satellite network, and that is only allowed from the 1st of August. So that might go off sometime early in August. We do have a test launch from Boeing, which is supposed to happen at the end of July, which is another unmanned launch of their Dragon capsule to go up to the space station. So that's an alternative to Dragon. It's the Boeing alternative to that. I think they're the two main things going on. But we can talk about Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson maybe later on if you like.
Yeah, we will do that in the third segment of the show. Yeah, okay, and Richard Branson he's just launched Virgin. Now I get mixed up now. Virgin, the one that went up the other day.
He's successfully launched satellites using his launch system, which is basically a jumbo jet with a booster underneath the wing, which will launch a satellite. And that's actually now launched commercial satellites. So that's a step forward.
It was a bit underwhelming watching the launch, but never mind.
Well, that's right. I mean, a lot of this stuff is going to become more and more routine. So it's a little bit like the Starlink satellites, isn't
indeed,
it?
Indeed,
Oh, another 50 Starlink satellites. You know, it becomes very blasé after a while, don't you?
Okay. Right, Paul, one of your favourite topics is photographing in space. Photographing the Milky Way, what can you give us advice on that, or what have you been doing?
Well, we're coming into the perfect season for having a go at this now. Late July and into August, the Milky Way ends up riding high above our heads here in the UK and is most prominent. So if you want to try and photograph the Milky Way from these islands, now's the time, really. The way to do it is, first of all, get away from the city lights, get out into the countryside with your camera, and make sure that you spend at least 20 minutes to half an hour with no lights at all, or just a red light, dim red light, to allow your eyes to expand and open up and the chemistry inside them to adapt to seeing in the dark. And then you'll see the Milky Way riding high above your head. It goes right past the bright star Deneb, which is one of the three members of the Summer Triangle, Deneb, Altair and Vega. And so it's an easy signpost. And so what I recommend, actually, is you use Deneb as a guide and point your camera up at Deneb, put it on a tripod, perhaps a DSLR with a 28mm lens or a 50mm lens is about right, Set it to the second highest ISO setting that you can. That's the amount of digital amplifier you've got turned on. I never set them to the maximum because it always overcooks it if you do that. So the second highest setting. And then about 30 seconds, maybe a minute if it's a wide-angle lens, 30 seconds if it's a 50 millimeter, is enough to get a really good image of the star clouds of the Milky Way and all of the dirty, dusty regions wending their way and weaving through it. And you'll also be able to pick out our whole range of interesting nebulae and clusters within it as you examine the photograph. The North American Nebula will be there, the Crescent Nebula, the Dumbbell Nebula. They'll all appear quite small, but nevertheless in the photograph. And it's great fun trying to pick them all out and use a star map or some an app on your phone to help guide you as to what you might be looking at when you examine the photograph. But it's now is the time to do it, because in the winter that we really are looking out of the galaxy when we look at the night sky. In the summer, we're looking in towards the center of the galaxy, and so the Milky Way is that much denser.
Right. So I assume you've got a fair few photographs yourself then of the Milky Way.
I've done a few. The one that I use on my backdrop on my screen on my computer.
Yeah.
The one I took of the Milky Way.
Are there any up on the Cambridge AA website?
Some of them are up there on the website, yes. And I think I entered the Milky Way picture in the one of our photo competitions once before I became chairman, because I don't enter now because it would be cheating. but if you do get any photos, anybody, then do remember we do run our little photo competition usually just before Christmas. And so, you know, we'd be very happy to see what you've produced. That'd be very interesting.
And listeners, I do urge you to visit the Cambridge Astronomical Association website. It's caa-cya.org. Is that right, Paul?
That is correct, yes. Cambridge Astronomical Association Cambridge Young Astronomers, caa-cya.
And that actually also just to emphasise, we are very, very keen to have as many young astronomers join us as we possibly can. And there is a young astronomers section in the photography competition as well, usually with quite a reasonable prize. So we welcome younger attention as well.
We have a monthly piece in the Hunt's Post, by the way, the station, gentlemen. And I script that out. And I've already got a mention of our show that we do for the Sky Tonight. And I've also given CAA a bit of a plug. So hopefully people will read that.
Excellent. Thank you.
Do you want to mention deep sky objects, Paul, before we go on to the general night sky, or do you want to leave that under the night sky topic?
I can tackle it now if you like.
Go on then, tackle it now, and then we'll start off with Jonathan with what he's going to look for in the night sky.
So okay, the main constellations that we can see up in the higher above the horizon, which are always the place to look. Don't look at things that are down near the horizon, because you're looking through horizontally through too much air and therefore dust and dirt. So look up, and what we find is the constellations at this time of year: Hercules, the hero, Lyra, which is a Greek musical instrument, Cygnus, very large constellation containing that bright star Deneb and the Milky Way running right along its back. These are all excellent places to go and sweep with binoculars. You'll find that there's just more stars than you could possibly count if you use binoculars. And deep sky object-wise, so nebulae and galaxies and star clusters, I would always start at this time of year with one of my favourites, which is the Great Globular Cluster in Hercules. You can just about see it with the naked eye. Binoculars show it as a small fuzzy blob, but even a small telescope, and suddenly it'll jump out at you. There's 500,000 stars organized in a little ball, and they look like diamonds on a velvet background. They're absolutely stunning. That's also very easy to find because it's two-thirds of the way up one side of the Keystone, which is four stars in Hercules, so it's almost got a signpost pointing to it. There are other globular clusters. There's Messier 92 in Hercules as well, so if you want to start tracking down more of them, there are plenty to go for. And then we've got the so-called planetary nebulae, which are nothing to do with planets, but are the death throes of sun-like stars. So when a star like the sun runs out of fuel, it first of all turns into a red giant, but then blows off its outer atmosphere to form like a smoke ring in space. And there are two very prominent ones at this time of year. There's the Dumbbell Nebula, which is large enough to see with binoculars as a pair of triangular grey fuzzy patches. But with a telescope, you'll see a lot more detail, and you can make out how it's the result of a ring of material being thrown off both the north and south spin axes of a dying star. And you'll even see the dead star as a white dwarf in the center. And then if you have a medium-sized telescope, then you can find, in the constellation of Lyra again, you can find the Ring Nebula, which is perhaps the best and most impressive one, only it's very, very small, so it's too small for binoculars to be able to resolve it. But with a high magnification and a medium-sized telescope, it's absolutely stunning. And you even sometimes get colour rings with the pink colour from hydrogen. And again, if you can photograph either of them with a camera attached to the telescope, they come out supremely well. They're easily bright enough that you don't have to have all the tricks in the book applied to get a good picture.
Good, thanks. Carry
on. Just finally, there's one very large object, which is the North American Nebula, just next to Deneb. It's so called because it looks like the outline of the North American continent. And for that, binoculars are the right thing, and a telescope won't help you because a telescope will have too narrow a field of view. So you won't see it. You need a much wider field to see the whole of it because it's rather large. So it's worth going after.
Good. Thanks for that, Porth, very much indeed. We need a short break again, gentlemen, and then we'll be back with the July night skies.
The night sky in focus and the latest news from space. This is The Sky Tonight with Pete Singleton and Cambridge astronomers Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough, only on HCR 104 FM.
Welcome back to The Sky Tonight with me, Pete Singleton, and Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough. Right, the night sky for July. Jonathan, do you want to kick us off with what you're going to look for?
Yes, certainly. I'll just sort of finishing off or carrying on from what Paul was saying with the summer triangle. One thing which is really, I find quite fascinating, is that you've got the three stars which make up the summer triangle, Deneb, Altair and Vega. Similar brightnesses, although Deneb is the dimmer of the three. But in fact, two of them are very close to us, 16.7 light years away. That's Altair. Vega isn't much further away. It's only about 25 light years away. But Deneb is right out in the distance. It's 3,500 light years away. And it's a massive, great star. It's actually 19 times more massive than our sun. And it's about 200 times the sun's radius. So it's nearly 200,000 times the luminosity of the sun. So you have these three stars looking similar in brightness, but the Deneb is just so much brighter. It's just so much further away. It's a challenge. So I find that fascinating. You can see these things so far away. Moving on to other things in the sky, we have our full moon, of course. There's a full moon nearly every month. And this year, or this month, it's on July the 24th.
Come on, man, I want to know what it's called.
You want to know what it's called? Yeah. I've got lots of names for this one, but the main one is the full buck moon, because apparently it's the antlers of the male deer are in full growth mode at this time. So it's once again, this is a North American name. I quite like a couple of other names. One is the thunder moon. And also the halfway summer moon, so referring to the stormy weather and the summer season. So watch out for your thunderstorms. Okay. So that's the moon. We still have the opportunity. I still haven't seen any yet, but noctilucent clouds are still a possibility. Because the night is so short, it doesn't really get that dark. But if you are around either just before the sun comes up or a little while after the sun's gone down, you can sometimes see these clouds. They're very high in the sky, but they get illuminated because they're so high in the sky after the sun is no longer visible from our point of view. And they can be quite silvery and ethereal. So quite a nice sight and another nice thing to photograph.
Indeed. Paul, let's see what you're going to look for.
Well, I picked out the 12th of July as a good night to go out and have a look, because the thin crescent of the moon is going to be very, very close to the planet Venus in the evening sky.
Right.
Venus will be shining very brightly. So once the sun's gone down, look over to the southwest and you can't miss it, really. Venus will be ever so bright. And it'll be very, very close in the sky to the thinnest of thin crescents of the moon. So actually, Venus will probably outshine the moon overall. And you may see Venus before you manage to spot the moon. But they'll be so close together that it's going to be really quite a good sight. The other planets, Mercury and Mars, are both in the gloom now, too close to the sun. So we can't see those. But Jupiter and Saturn are becoming more accessible. You still have to be quite a night owl and stay up well after midnight into the small hours to see them low and in the south, but they're getting better as the year goes on. And Jupiter will come to its opposition first in a month or so's time, followed by Saturn. But so we're going to get better views as the time goes on. So for those of you interested in looking at the planets and, of course, tracking down their moons, always good to see how many moons you can see for each of the giant planets. So really, it's just those three, Venus, Jupiter and Saturn.
Jonathan, have you got anything else you want to mention on the July night sky?
No, I think Paul's covered it over. I mean, my notes say that potentially you might just catch a glimpse of Mars on that same evening, 12th, 13th of July, when you've got Venus in the sky, but it'll be very dim and very low down, I agree. But you might actually get the Moon, Mars and Venus all together.
Good. Right. I'd like to mention a story that's recently been in the news. In fact, I think it was on the TV news last night. Now, Wally Funk, who's got a great name, it just sounds so much better than my name. She was one of 13 female aviators who lobbied for women to become astronauts in the early days of spaceflight. Now, there's a story behind this, is there not, Jonathan?
Yes, definitely. You mentioned the 13 aviators, and they were called the Mercury 13. They were a group of women pilots, very well-qualified pilots, who actually entered the competition, if you like, to become astronauts with NASA in the early days. You may remember the Mercury 7 and the movie The Right Stuff. So these 13 women went through the same program of assessment, physical assessment, tests and aptitude with the same overall examiner, and these 13 passed it. In fact, the pass rate for women was better than the pass rate for men. And they went through it on the pretext that they would therefore be able to potentially be astronauts. But I think, unfortunately, it was too early in women's liberation. It didn't happen. And so the Mercury 7 were all men, and the Mercury 13 never flew. So it was very unfortunate. But the good news is now that Wally Funk, who is 82 now, has been offered a place on the Blue Origin spaceship by Jeff Bezos.
The Amazon guy.
He's the Amazon man, yeah. That's right. He's flying with his brother, I believe, on this first launch. He's now invited Wally Funk to go as his guest, if you like. And there is a fourth seat, which has been auctioned off. So there'll be four astronauts flying on this suborbital flight. Unfortunately for Wally Funk, she won't actually get into orbit, but she will get into space. It's a suborbital flight. It's only a few minutes of weightlessness, but she will actually be officially an astronaut because she'll have passed the Kármán line, this over 100-kilometre line. And so we'll finally get her wish fulfilled.
That's a great news story, isn't it, really? Yeah. Really good. And I believe she's written a book as well, which I actually haven't read yet, but it's one on my list to read, and I think that'll be quite good. We've really come to the point where we look at some what's-ons. Paul, have you got anything for us? There must be lots on the Cambridge circuit.
Well, we've got three things that I'd like to mention. First of all, we've got Dr. Emma Curtis-Lake coming to, electronically to talk to us via Zoom about the James Webb Telescope and her research that she's going to do with it, hopefully, once it's launched in the autumn. And that's going to be on Friday, the 16th of July. On the 30th, we have our Cambridge Young Astronomers meeting on the Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, again via Zoom. And anyone's welcome to join that. We give priority to the children in terms of asking questions and so on, but we're not too fussy who joins really at the moment, as it's all done remotely. And we're talking about rocky planets for that one. And Brian will be there with one of his usual fun games and so on. And then finally, tomorrow night, Wednesday, we have the final part of our Introduction to Astronomy course. So it's part 12 of 12, and it's going to be entitled Cosmic Dawn and Destiny. So it's everything to cover from the Big Bang itself right through to the eventual fate of the universe. Mm. We're going to do that all in just an hour. So that'll be tomorrow night, Wednesday at 8 o'clock.
I suppose in a way, lockdown has sort of helped progress this sort of thing forward, hasn't it? Because, you've had quite a few lectures via Zoom or whatever you use.
We have, and it's going to be very interesting with lockdown coming to an end. We're going to have to decide exactly what the split's going to be between using the remote technology and not doing so and having people in person. I think having people in person is going to be very popular and great fun and more social and so on.
Of course. But
we have been able to get people from further afield by using Zoom. So we may end up with a bit of a mixture.
Sure. Yeah. Got a couple of minutes in hand, gentlemen. And perhaps I can just ask about the history of the association. I'm sorry this is putting you on the spot, guys, but Gina, can you tell me when the association was first formed?
It was 1959, so it's 62 years old now, I think it was April of 1959, I was talking all about this not so long ago when we had our 60th anniversary celebration, so I remember looking it all up, and it was formed then, is one of the older, but not the oldest, association in the country. I think the oldest one really goes back to, I think it's Liverpool for the local ones, plus the Royal Astronomical Society in London, of course. In terms of local ones, a lot of them were born in and around the late 50s, early 60s, because of the space race, because of Mercury, Gemini and Apollo. That really got everybody's interest going. So that's when it first started.
And you've had a long association with the Institute of Astronomy, haven't you, at the university?
We have. There's a separate students' club, the Cambridge University Astronomical Society, and that's been going a very long time. But the townie amateurs got together with the Institute of Astronomy when Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 was going to hit Jupiter.
Right.
And that involved everybody suddenly wanting to observe the event live. And so they put a program together to between the Institute of Astronomy and the CAA to create an observing evening for it. We had the End of the World Star Party and Barbecue, I think it was called. Put together the first of our live observing evenings with a primitive camera, video camera attached to a telescope so that we could show everybody at once, because about 2,000 people tried to turn up. And it was absolutely rammed. So, and that gave birth really then to the public observing evenings being a joint production between the university and the CAA from then on. So that was 1996, I think, since when we've been doing the Wednesday night observing evenings 20 times a year, all the way through the autumn and spring terms, and co-producing the Introduction to Astronomy course that I mentioned, of which the last one is tomorrow.
Right. Obviously, Paul, you're the chairman. Jonathan, what's your involvement?
I'm the events secretary for my sins, so I find our monthly external speakers. And as Paul says, the interesting thing will be transitioning back to having people in person in the lecture room. And in some ways, I say, I don't think we've taken as much advantage as we could have done, but we have had one or two very distant speakers and some people who could only speak to us because it was distant. So I get involved with that. I also work with Paul on the public observing evening. So he and I are the presenters of the Sky Tour, as we call it. And we also get involved with the University Science Week, which happens once a year. The Institute of Astronomy is open to the public with various things going on, and we host a small area to talk about the CAA and introduce people to the club, particularly, as I say, young astronomers, but also older people who want to join our group.
Good. So I do urge anyone who wants to get in touch with the association to go onto the website. As we said, it's caa-cya.org, and you'll find everything you need to know. So, gentlemen, it's been a great show. Thank you very much once again for your work and what you've done, and we hope to see you again next week. So thank you. So this has been The Sky Tonight from HCR 104 FM, presented by me, Pete Singleton, with input and research from Paul Fellows and Jonathan Clough. Coming up at 10, it's The Late Show with Tony Obey. Following the news and local weather at 8, it's Rock and Roll with John Rea. From all of us in this particular part of the universe, until next time, on the Tuesday, the 3rd of August at 7 o'clock in the evening, we wish you all a very good night. Good night from Paul.
Good night.
And good night from Jonathan.
Good night, all.
And from me, good night. Thank you.